This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash on the 121st anniversary of the massacre at Wounded Knee. Indigenous people connected the colonial occupation of Manhattan to Occupy Wall Street, an occupation of already occupied land. They gathered in order to initiate an open dialogue with Occupy Wall Street to raise local and national awareness of ongoing Native struggles and to recognize that the injustices and inequalities we currently confront are the bricks and mortar of conquest and settler colonialism.
Unsettling Occupation called upon Occupy Wall Street in its yearnings to voice the experiences of the 99% to make space for those most marginalized. As stated during the evening, let us pass the mic, turn up the volume, listen to Native voices, and break down the culture of domination and find roads which we can walk down together.
Unsettling Occupation. Occupy Wall Street stands with Indigenous Americans. Let's hear from Janice Richards, Oglala Sioux activist and educator, Firewolf Nelson Huang, a Diné Indian and AIM member and activist, Joseph, an Indigenous activist, and Christopher Hedges, journalist activist, and Raymond Two Hawks, a Narragansett Nation, Rhode Island Territory Indigenous American.
Yate Shina Ash. Hello, my friends. I'm Diné, which is basically the inclusive word for the Navajo people and the Apache people. Our name is Diné, which means the people. I was practically born into activism. My father, Jimmy Bizaholoni, was at the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969 for 9 months. I was seven then, but I remember playing in the jail cells and how it was always freezing cold there. I formally joined AIM myself when I was 15 and participated in my first direct action at age 17. I was raised in the traditional ways of my people, taught to respect the land, our people, our ancestors. I was taught our history, the real ones, not the lies they tell you in the school books. We were raised to be damn proud of who we are. The U.S. government lied, stole, cheated our native people, took our traditional homelands and herded us onto reservations like cattle. The one thing they couldn't take or break is our spirits. I have personally experienced violent racist attacks, including one which almost cost my life at the age of 10. I have my scars, both inside and out, but a warrior's scars tell their story. All my life, I have fought for my people. It's often been frustrating, but I never once thought of giving up. I'll never allow anyone to take my voice. I came out to New York City in 1996 to raise awareness and gather support for what was then the Black Mesa Coalition, now called Black Mesa Indigenous Support. We were fighting for the indigenous people of Black Mesa, Arizona, in our resistance to the massive coal mining operations, destroying our land and our people. We also fought the forced relocation policies of the U.S. government. Since 1974, earlier even, federal relocation policies have forced over 14,000 Diné from their homeland. This genocidal policy was crafted by government agents and energy company representatives in order to gain access to the mineral resources of Black Mesa, which is billions of tons of coal, uranium, and natural gas. For over 30 years, traditional Diné at Black Mesa have lived in resistance, steadfastly refusing to relocate as strip mines rip apart our sacred lands and generating plants poison the desert, air, and water. Most of the people on my reservation have no plumbing, no electricity. The water is carried in plastic containers hauled from the river that is polluted with uranium. How does anyone even vocalize that, you know? Unfortunately, no one wanted to know about the problems of Native Americans, except, of course, other Native Americans. I continued working with Black Mesa and also working with NARF, the Native American Rights Fund. Once here, I was made aware of various labor organizations, such as Chinese Staff and Workers Association. I met my husband there, an Asian American activist who fought by my side. I've worked with various other movements, from student groups to labor groups, all of which have left their mark on me and helped my growth as an activist. When the occupation took over Zuccotti Park on September 17th, at first I was a bit wary. I remember thinking to myself, a bunch of white college kids took over the park. Cool. You know? But it was so much more than that. I first went down there a week later, and I was stunned. The energy, passion, and determination I saw and felt all around me filled me with excitement and enthusiasm. Other people of color were heard to remark that this was a white kid thing, and that very few people of color were involved. So many other people of color put it out there. People of color would be a part of this if they came down and got involved. And we did. We needed to add our voices to this movement, which has swept the country and has gained international support on all seven continents. And yes, Antarctica too. We got a picture from them. In the wake of the Arab Spring, the revolts in Greece, Spain, and Chile, the occupation movement to take the power from the ultra-rich and multi-million dollar corporations and put it back into the hands of the people has touched a common nerve, a nerve that has crossed class lines, race, gender, politics, and belief systems. People from all different walks of life have united to join and support the various occupations around the country. The energy and devotion is still going strong, if not stronger than before. Still, even within this unified movement, so filled with determination, racism is an issue, whether it's intentional, as it has been in some cases, or the result of ignorance. The racism in the Occupy movement needs to be dealt with. Within the first few weeks, people of color who joined the occupation felt marginalized in the decision-making process and in discussions. A People of Color caucus came together in order to help our voices be heard. It started well enough. I'm part of it myself. But even within people of color, they're a minority. Non-Native people are speaking about injustices the Native people have gone through and suffered. They have no actual idea what we have gone through, what we have suffered through, the atrocities we've survived. Yet why are non-Natives speaking about this? I mean, however good their intentions are, why are they speaking about this when actual Natives are not being heard? We can damn well speak for ourselves, and surely better than any non-Native person. Yet when we try to speak out, we try to talk, suddenly live streams run out of time and journalists already have all that they need. Nobody listens to us. This needs to change now. My comrades and I here tonight will no longer be silenced. We are not going away. We will not be marginalized or ignored any longer. We are all part of this movement. We won't ignore our differences, but we can respect each other's differences and embrace them to unify.
And I'm speaking with
Janice Richards,
Oglala Sioux from the Pioneer Indian Reservation. What brings you to Brooklyn specifically?
One of my friends, Charles Abras, he's an activist back at home and an attorney. He asked me to come. He explained to me what was going on here. And he said, can you go there and speak? Because you were born and raised on a reservation. You've been through many, many of the injustices, the atrocities that happened to our Lakota people. You understand them, so you're able to talk about them while you're there. And to give them some encouragement on what's going on with the occupation here at Wall Street, that we all on common ground as Indigenous people and people across the nation.
I'm just interested in your own thoughts on the name or the concept of Occupy Wall Street.
Occupation amongst the Indian people is to stand up and say, fight for our rights. fight for what we believe is true for us as Lakota people, as Native people. We say occupied, but the indigenous peoples were the first occupants of this nation. We were the first people here on this land. We, as indigenous peoples, we're not afraid to go and protest or go and occupy because we're fighting for something that we believe in.
What would you say today are the major concerns for those who reside in Pine Ridge for the Lakota people?
Healthcare is a big issue with our people. The funding of many of our schools and our healthcare. I don't think anyone outside of the reservation can even imagine that our people sit at the hospital for 10 to 12 hours before they even get seen. Many of our people die while waiting in the waiting room trying to get seen. There's not enough doctors that come to the reservation, so healthcare is a big issue. We have high rates of alcoholism, drugs, diabetes, cancer, yet there's not enough funding to provide for our Lakota people.
Are you affirmative about Occupy Wall Street, or where do you consider the Lakota people in the concept of we are the 99%?
The Indian people are the 99%. We're here. We're here. And to the occupiers here at Wall Street, we need to come together with all the indigenous people to make our voice heard.
How has the Occupied Wall Street movement resonated back on Pine Ridge, if it has?
There's so much going on at home. There's so much stuff that are going amongst our people. People just trying to make a living just to survive, that many times they're not even aware of what's going on worldwide. They're not thinking about it because our struggle is so big on the reservation. People trying to find a place to live. People trying to find a place to eat. So our struggle within our people, our reservations, is so heavy that oftentimes we don't even understand what's going on out here. Back home, when they talk about recession, they talk about the economy collapsing. It's collapsed on the reservation from the beginning. We've been in recession all these years. We've been struggling all these years. And so when people nationwide are talking in those terms, Lakota people, we've already been living through that. But I see the movement of our people to get out to vote. There's many, many people out there that are really pushing the education to that it's important that we as indigenous peoples get out there and vote and make our voices heard. For too long, we've been sitting back. For too long, we've been waiting, and we can't wait anymore. We have to move forward.
What would you suggest as a major message from our sisters and brothers, the Lakota people, to those of us in Brooklyn, in New York, and indeed those of us who are part of the Occupy Wall Street movement and view it with great hope and possibility?
Continue to fight, because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So to continue to fight, continue to organize and come up and understand why they're occupying Wall Street. To be really clear with their agenda on what it is, and to continue that fight and to build allies to get that word out. And what's happening here is happening across the nation.
And I've been speaking with
Janice Richards, Oglala Sioux from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation.
Christopher Hedges, you've certainly been an advocate and participant in Occupy Wall Street. It's clearly morphing into a new stage since the eviction. What do you feel the imperative for an Occupy Wall Street movement is? What's your own sense of where it needs to go?
It's important to have a physical space, a kind of town hall, a community center. The People's Library was very important, and I think you saw a lot of people mourn its loss, the destruction of 5,000 books by the New York City Police Department. Was painful, because this isn't a movement just about politics. It's about reclaiming politics. It's about reclaiming culture, reclaiming who we are and our self-expression and the power to transform ourselves. And the corporate state has decimated culture just like it's decimated the political system. So I'm a great advocate. I've been involved in trying to get this space owned by this corporation masquerading as a church known as Trinity. one of the largest landholders in Manhattan. The rector has a salary of $1.2 million and a title of CEO. I mean, it's just obscene. As somebody who actually comes out of seminary, I couldn't think of the antithesis of the Gospels. So getting that space, or getting some space, doing things like tonight, raising consciousness, reaching out to groups like Native Americans who have not only been marginalized but ignored, and hearing their story and understanding that they've been fighting this a lot longer than we have, and we have a lot to learn from them. I think the movement is very aware of that. Fundamentally, this movement is not going away because the power elite's response to try and physically erase it by removing the 18 encampments. If they understood the pain that most Americans are going through and the injustices that have been visited on tens of millions of the citizens of this country, they would have immediately canceled all student debt, called for a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, and they would have started a $1 trillion jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25. The fact that they think that they can send in their stormtroopers and eradicate it, and the problem will go away, shows how misguided and tone deaf they are. Because all of the suffering, all of the injustices that gave birth to this movement are not only still there, but growing, and they don't know how to respond to them.
Do you think that the message needs to deepen, that the context of the 99% has to begin to follow the proposal of solutions as to what creates the economic deprivation that is the motivator behind this movement?
No, I think the movement has a high degree of political consciousness. And I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and I heard the same kind of criticisms. Authorities would say, tell us what your demands are. Well, they have a very clear-cut demand, which is the corporate coup has to be reversed. The corporate oligarchs have to go. And that is, of course, a demand that means the dissolution of the power elite. And it's just why they can't hear it and why they keep coming and asking us to become supplicants again within a dead system. So the power of this movement is that it gets it. And that at once mystifies and on a certain level terrifies those in power, because they know even better than you or I how utterly corrupt and gamed the system is against us. The bottom line is there is no way in America to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And they know that even better than we do.
Last time I saw you, you were being carried away at Goldman Sachs. And I actually was there recently, and I was dressed as a giant blood-sucking,
one of
those squids. Christopher Hedges, thank you for speaking with us.
Not at all, thanks.
And I'm here with a brother who I just happened to hear, say, from Rhode Island.
Yes.
So you're not Lakota?
No, I'm Narragansett.
And what brings you to Brooklyn?
Well, our good friend Joseph is very active in occupation out here. We actually met him coming out to the occupation, Occupy Wall Street. When we did meet him, he actually led us on an 80-block journey from Zuccotti Park, Liberty Square, to Columbus Circle, connect with an indigenous festival that was going on there. We came back out here after that when we drummed, and we're just trying to stand up for people's rights. I think that the Native element is very much lacking in the occupation movement as a whole, and we're trying to do our part to make sure that the Natives are represented well.
What do you think that Occupy Wall Street can do for the various issues that surround indigenous people here?
Sure, because in Providence, we're actively involved with Occupy Providence as well. Anytime the occupation goes somewhere, the media comes, people listen, stories get written about it. So we think doing events like this, where you're highlighting issues that are facing Native community, achievements, highlighting challenges, it helps to educate the community as a whole. And we think that our story is the most important one that needs to be told, because the occupation has been happening to us since European contact. And if you want to talk about livelihoods being taken, being forced into a situation where you feel you have no other choice but to fight, who better than the Natives to share that with you and also point out what mistakes perhaps we've made in the past? Particular one I see is lack of unity. Being from the East, that's kind of where this all started. If we had stopped fighting with each other and got together and saw what was coming, perhaps this situation that we're in right now would be different. Unity is the number one issue that natives as a whole need to have, humanity as a whole. And I think that doing things like this, allowing different nations to come together, allowing us to tell our story to people who perhaps haven't heard it before, maybe didn't hear it from our point of view. Stuff like that's very important because you never know what gears start turning in people's minds.
The young people in an urban area like Rhode Island, do they relate to, have they been able to move beyond the traumas that they face economically and so on and lend their spirit to the struggle of their people, the struggle of the 99%?
They're getting there. A lot of it has to do with people just being jaded with the fact that every time they promise something's going to help, halfway through funding gets cut or, you know, something funny is always going on. I actually run a community center back in Providence, so I see this firsthand. And a lot of it also has to do with them not even being educated about the history of things. They're listening to the rappers, they're listening to politicians, they're listening to the actors, and what are they really telling them that's truthful? Actors are professional liars. Politicians are professional liars. Most rappers are professional liars. They get paid to push an image on you or get you to think a certain way that isn't necessarily good for the spirit or good for the people as a whole. That's why we also think it's doubly important that we be out here doing this sort of stuff so that they get the other side of the story, the side that's righteous, the side that thinks about us, not just myself. We think that's very important.
The problems of the country and certain groups of people like the indigenous people seem insurmountable. What would you say a critical agenda item has to be for indigenous people and one that certainly should be taken up by Occupy Wall Street?
The number one thing, and I'll bring it back to why we're here with the drum, the spirit. You can occupy physical space all you want, but if the spirit behind it is not what it needs to be able to develop beyond that, it's not going to go anywhere. We would like to see the spirit of unity. We would like to see the spirit of truth. Even within the occupation, sometimes there's a lack of unity or lack of willingness to let certain people speak and things of that nature. And to me, that's the most scary because I see so much potential with this movement because of all the people it's bringing together. But if it can't get the right spirit, people aren't coming in unity.
And the name of the community center?
I run the Mount Hope Neighborhood Association in Providence, Rhode Island.
And what does it do?
Oh, goodness. Community development, seniors programming, youth, food bank, pretty much whatever the neighborhood needs, advocacy, activism, we do it all.
And you are?
My name's Raymond Two Hooks from the Wachanit Band of the Narragansett Nation in Rhode Island Territory.
And you are also a musician.
Yeah.
So the role of music, and particularly the role of the music that you're immersed in. So
music as a whole has the ability to either uplift or depress the spirit. And I mean that literally. I don't mean that figuratively. Like, I truly believe there's a spiritual world that's around us at all times. There's constantly spiritual warfare going on, and it influences us one way or another. Spirit of greed, spirit of selfishness. These sorts of things are what cause people to have to rebel, stand up for themselves. We consider ourselves the Wachumchik warrior drum to be a spiritual drum. You will see it at events where people are standing up for their rights, people are telling the truth, and when we come and when we drum, it just does something to you. It makes you feel good. You forget about some of your cares. You forget about some of your worries. You just listen to the music. In particular, a lot of the songs that we share, the meaning behind them, also whether you know that meaning or not, I also believe that that has an effect on you as well. So there's going to be one more song that we're going to do. It's actually a healing song that was gifted to me by our brother, Adi Red Medicine. He's actually from the Shinnecock Nation in Long Island. And it's a healing song, and from the first and only time he sung it, we were at an anti-bullying rally. To me, given everything that's going on with Wall Street and the 1% and all that, what better time to be singing that song than when we're at the occupation?
This person was the voice for the indigenous people in the park, so I'd like to introduce Joseph.
Joseph! we still live in an incarcerated society. And they have the word freedom. And you got two words in there, free and Edom, you know, which is ancient Idumea. We're still in Rome, you know, and they're trying to get us to be Romans, and they're trying to get us to all assimilate to the greater society, whatever, you know, to fit in. They had a program back in the late 50s, take the Indians off the reservation to assimilate them. Beyond forced assimilation in the boarding schools and everything else, they were trying to relocate Indians into the cities. And there were a lot of, you know, elders. They're now old, some of them are past, but they relocated into many of these different cities. And that was part of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Bureau of Indian Affairs was led by a guy that was, back in the 50s, was the same guy that put the Japanese in the concentration camps. So he had a lot of good practice at putting people, you know, like reservations and looking over the reservation. The BIA is a $1 billion ripoff every year. It's all bureaucracy, red tape, people sitting on their hands. And right now the Indians are starving, and that's literally. The poorest place in the country, in the North America, the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Abject poverty. You think that people don't squeeze a tea bag 10 times. Go to someone's house in this inclement weather, this life-threatening weather. Bread bags for windows. No one can get gas money just to go eat somewhere, to try to get some food. That's what we're talking about right now. This is the continuation of this colonization. We say decolonize Wall Street, we say decolonize America. But most of all, you got to occupy a higher consciousness. Instead of walking around and looking at a geographical location, that doesn't mean anything. Zuccotti Park is just a place that you can occupy for a certain amount of time. But you take yourself with you wherever you go. So you got to renew yourself. That's real. That's got to stay with you. The retinence of these words that we're giving you tonight, these are good teachings. It's not a new age thing. This is reality. It's like a big river. You got all kinds of currents and everything else inside that river. One's going this way, one's going that way, but you don't realize that the river, the whole river's going in one direction. And that's all of us right now. So this 99% thing, you know, I think it's just people waking up and, you know, realizing exactly where you're at. You're in a sophisticated form of slavery. You call it debt. Can't claim bankruptcy because you're a student or a convicted felon. That's the two people that can't claim bankruptcy. And remember about the Marshal Leonard Peltier. He's still incarcerated right now while we're speaking. You know, it's a reality. You know, he's in a cell. He's been there for a lifetime. So that's it.
And you've been listening to Unsettling Occupation. Occupy Wall Street stands with Indigenous Americans. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.